And help KPFT reduce its pledge drives. What's a sustainer? Rather than giving a yearly gift, sustainers give a monthly donation that continues as long as you want. Giving $20, $100, or $500 monthly helps change the way KPFT operates. From having to meet our operating expenses through days and days of on-air fundraising, to friends of the station boosting it off-air throughout the fiscal year. Contact our development director at 713-526-4000 to inquire about our sustainer program. Did you know sustainers can ultimately give a gift that is substantially larger than annual givers? That means less pledge drive, more efficiency, and greater stability for KPFT, regardless of the time of year. Again, just call our development director at 713-526-4000 to inquire about our sustainer program. Make a difference today. This is KPFT Houston.
You're listening to 90.1 FM KPFT Houston.
Listeners should be aware that the following program contains language and audio images which may be found disturbing and may not be suitable for your snotty-nosed little brat who probably cusses like a sailor behind your back anyway. Parental discretion is advised.
Greetings and welcome to the Jay's Flown the Coop show.
Jay walked out and left his computer unlocked.
I'm gonna get teabagged. All right, welcome to Technology Bites. I'm Jay Lee.
I'm Peter Hughes.
I'm Flicted.
I'm Barrett.
I'm Lee.
And he's
Roofhouse.
All right, so we are experiencing the usual batch of technical difficulties as we strive to bring Peter Hughes onto the show via the Skypes.
Perfect show.
He was supposed to come in. He's actually toying with the idea of coming into the studio.
Oh.
But that didn't happen.
Might be on the road.
He might be.
He might be. Maybe he's on his way here. Maybe he's barreling towards us now.
All things
falling
are possible.
Down, Lovett. 80 miles an hour.
Yeah. All right. So anyway, you can visit us online at geekradio.com. That's the website. And you can check out all previous podcasts and Geek Gathering announcements and so forth. So that's all there for you. You can also hang out with us on IRC, irc.cuckoo.com,
cuckoo.
And channel Tech Bites. If you don't have your own IRC application or you have one and you don't know how to use it, feel free to use our Java-based IRC client on the website. Just look for IRC at geekradio.com, and you can come join us, the show within a show. Anything goes in IRC up to the point where we kick ban you. But other than that, it's all good. And the phone number, if you want to be on the air with us tonight or have something to discuss, is 713-526-5738. So we have that to look forward to. And I'm in the IRC, maybe. Yes, I did it.
Not just IRC, but the IRC.
Yeah.
You're in the IRC.
The IRC. RC, the IRC in a moon pie. All right, so...
I'm going to get into IRC chat, too.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Did you get some money out of the ATM machine?
I forgot my PIN number.
Are you on the... did you get your NIC card working? All right, so...
Okay, now I get it.
Catch up.
I was like, wait, what are we talking about?
Oh, it was Snark, and it went misidentified by you.
I know, I was like, man, just... Oh.
Oh, we're prank calling.
Who's calling?
Jay, are you ready for this one?
Cookie Puss.
Vandalay Industries.
All right, so as we work on getting Peter Hughes onto the show... Let me bring up the Peter Hughes email of topics.
I have something I can lead off with that's right. Sort of tech entertainment-y and kind of interesting. So
we're interested.
The New Yorker, if you guys read The New Yorker, and I know you do.
For the cartoons.
ran a massive, like huge, like 10,000 word in-depth profile on Apple's Sir Jonathan Ive, who is, of course...
The designer
responsible for basically all of Apple's iconic products for the past... I don't know, 15, 16, 17 years.
The guy that found the Braun catalog?
The guy, yeah, pretty much, yes. So Johnny Ive, you know, he's a bald-headed Englishman who is...
Oi!
Who's strangely buff. If you've ever seen Johnny Ive, he's actually, like, really big. He's oddly large. Anyway.
Cute?
Yes, just...
Did you ask if he was cute?
Well, I smell a little bit of a man crush here. Not necessarily from me, just, you know.
Well, that's the way you said it, though. I think we can deflect that back onto you pretty easily.
I just like the way he designs products.
So, it's back on Lino.
So this profile the New Yorker ran on Johnny Ive, they were allowed just a tremendous amount of access into Apple. They got to get into Apple's design labs and see all kinds of stuff that previously the public really hasn't been able to see. Because, you know, Apple has the super secretive product cycle, and they're very, you know, they keep everything very, very close. But there was this really interesting tidbit in the article. So it turns out that Sir Jonathan Ive, Johnny Ive here, is...
He's a sir?
He is a sir. He has been knighted. He is buddies with director, producer, writer J.J. Abrams. And there is this neat little excerpt, probably about halfway through the article, and it says that Johnny Ive was, I'm not going to read the entire excerpt, but I'll just sort of summarize, Johnny Ive and J.J. Abrams were at what they call a boozy dinner party in New York, Johnny Ive apparently, having been talking about Star Wars with J.J. Abrams, since J.J. Abrams is, of course, you know, currently producing Star Wars Episode 7, made a couple of suggestions about stuff about lightsabers, about things he would like to see in lightsabers in the new movie.
Single button.
Well, what ended up happening, crazily enough, is his suggestion wasn't the like extra cross guard on the lightsaber that was in the trailer, but so we all noticed if you've seen the Episode 7 trailer that's on YouTube, there's a scene where there's like a hooded dark figure and he whips a lightsaber out and it's all and it like goes up and the lightsaber looks kind of like flickering and flamey instead of being like solid like regular lightsabers go. Mm-hmm. So in this article, Johnny Ive admits that the idea for a sort of, he uses the word spitty, but sort of a flickery lightsaber was his idea as kind of a way to add an ominous, more primitive hint to lightsaber design. So Apple's reach extends not just in this universe where they have the highest market cap out of any company ever, but Apple now is beginning to influence Star Wars directly through mind beams into J.J. Abrams' brain.
It could have been worse. It could have been all white with a scroll wheel. I think we got off lucky.
I'm thinking an aluminum and glass lightsaber. It's just all glass, and I know it's not really efficient, but I mean,
well,
you
go up against his first
nice.
Sith, and the screen would break. I don't think that's a good idea.
Well, you're holding it wrong if the screen breaks.
Right before the Sith kills the hero, he says, "And one more thing."
Spinny beach ball.
Wow.
Spinny beach ball.
That must mean we have Pete.
Cool. Hey, Pete.
Not yet.
Oh.
That's you. That's you, Jay. I don't hear myself echo back.
Y'all wanted to talk to him, so I turned it back up, even though it was looping.
How do I technology?
Learn to
do
technology.
Do you even tech, bro?
I don't even tech.
you should tech.
I don't tech. I don't know how to tech.
Oh, yeah, I was going to bring up the...
IIRC 250.
What?
What are we doing?
I was going to bring up the email of suggested discussion topics that Pete sent in.
Oh, I found out some... So, all the hacks lately, the Anthem hack was pretty big because it's insurance.
All the hacks?
Well, there have been... Yeah, all the hacks, pretty much. There have been a lot of large ones, like Target helped me out. So, there have been...
There was a big bank hack.
There was a big bank hack. But the more interesting one, I think, is the Anthem hack, because Anthem a while ago... bought Blue Cross Blue Shield, and Blue Cross Blue Shield is the primary insurer for all of the U.S. government's three-letter agencies like the FBI, NSA, all that stuff. And the trails point back to China. So, you know, you're kind of scratching your head going like, well, why would the Chinese want all this, you know, stuff for identity theft in the U.S.? Are they going to do it from over there? But really what they got, they just probably got the entire list of our entire cyber army, everyone that's, you know, involved in getting back at China. So I think that's why suddenly, and if you notice, it wasn't, you know, all these larger hacks happened, and it wasn't until, you know, this one happened that Obama came out and said, hey, we're doing full disclosure, companies are going to share information, and all that kind of hit at the same time. So it's not just me thinking that. I read that somewhere else, but it all kind of lines up and all kind of makes sense. So that's not a good thing.
Everybody
as far as, yeah, us getting in the game.
They just, the Chinese were not going to sit idly by and let HIPAA dictate terms to them.
No.
You'll have all your help.
And the big thing, too, is Anthem just, again, they didn't encrypt their social security numbers. So, wow. I mean, it's a lot of low-hanging fruit. You know, there's just a lot of information
wow.
floating around, and no one's doing
you know,
much of anything
that when
about
they,
it.
When they
That's
do
healthcare.
That, when they do that, the persons responsible for making those decisions should be prosecuted. The persons responsible for improperly protecting data, whether it was by accident or oversight or whatever, should be prosecuted for what happened.
Well, it's really, really tough. I mean, not to name any names, but, you know, we trade a lot of data at work, and we'll set up, you know, extreme safeguards to where we will encrypt files and exchange keys and, you know, exchange passwords, you know, out of band. And we'll, you know, on top of that, then we'll exchange files with PKI and digital signatures and all this stuff. And, you know, every once in a while, you know, extremely sensitive data, we'll get someone that's like an HR person or whatever. They'll just send a file, Excel file, unencrypted, full of all
sure.
this stuff
wow.
on over. And, you know, it'll be salaries, it'll be socials, it'll be all kinds of data. And sometimes it'll be, you know, for an entire company, it'll be 16,000, 20,000 people. Mm-hmm. And it's like you do all this stuff and you work so hard and then someone just clicks send on a big Excel file full of socials.
And it's usually, maybe I'm betraying my IT history and bias, it's usually somebody in HR, or it's usually an executive.
Yeah, that's why it's usually an HR person going like, hey, I heard you needed this report. I don't know how to get it for you, but here's all the data. Have fun.
Yeah, here you go.
Yeah, go figure it out.
Well, I mean, it was one of the problems with people being so lazy about how they're sending data. That's what I think is one of the downfalls of high-speed internet access is people are
it goes so quickly.
Sending so much data via email instead of, like, on some kind of encrypted file share or some kind of protected resource where you have to, like, know how to get there yourself, know how to put the data there, and then know how to tell someone to go there and get it. Instead, I'm going to attach a 20-meg Excel file to this email and send it to you.
And Google, I hate to point fingers at, you know, companies like Google and Yahoo, but they keep upping, you know, like, what is it, like 15 gigs of storage now with the Gmail account or something like that, 10? It's huge. So I do it too. I mean, I'll use it as a, you know, as my cloud, you know, file server, more or less. I'll email my stuff, things that I want to save. But there was a time when we said, hey, you know, if it's larger than like 500K, you're not going to put that as an attachment.
Oh,
we
yeah.
used to peel off, you know, attachments larger than a meg, but, you know, sales with their 30 meg PowerPoint presentations and all these other things, that just kind of somewhere within the last 5 or 6 years ago, that just kind of went by the wayside.
Well, there's tons of bad practice from just everybody, you know, using
yeah.
the internet and using networks and computers and stuff. They just, they learn bad habits. They consider that that's the normal way you do things, and they continue on, and then they teach their underlings how to do the same thing.
Only well, there are some people that could educate people on how to properly handle data.
Well, you know what?
Well, security is hard.
Security
is hard.
And it takes longer.
Security is hard, and this whole file transfer thing is hard, too. The reason why people use email is because for file transfers is because until that kind of that 4, 5, 6 year ago mark, every alternative sucked. You know, I mean, now you've got sync options, you've got, you know, SkyDrive, OneDrive, whatever it's called, you got Dropbox, you got all kinds of ways to do it. But before, I mean,
unless you're an IT practitioner,
practitioner,
and then you just
and
have
you
your
know
own SFTP server.
Yeah, you know how to use an FTP Dropbox or an FTP, you know, address or whatever, where you can like drop stuff off and have somebody pick it up later. It's like, you know what, just go ahead and just email the file. I can explain this to you, but it's just going to take so long.
In my role as the helpline columnist for the Houston Chronicle for a number of years, the single most over-asked question I ever got was, how do I bypass the logon password for Windows? I don't want to even be bothered typing in the password to log into my computer when it first starts up.
I know.
Also, I don't want to be bothered with going to Google and asking this question where it is outlined you know, 1,000 times over on the web. But I'm going to send you an email, and then you're going to email me back to tell me how to do it. And in the time it took to figure all of that out, you could have typed your password in 1,000 times.
Yeah, well.
But that's people are just really, really lazy about security, and they don't want to hear it, and they don't want to be bothered with it.
Well, because so much of it is done poorly. So much of it is a pain in the butt. I mean, you've got I don't blame the users. You know, that's like, you know, blaming the dog that poops in the middle of the living room. You know, the dog doesn't.
You hear that, users?
Give me the newspaper. Someone hand me a rolled up newspaper.
It's the fact that
rolled up manual.
It's the fact that corporate IT, and I say this as you know, I'm not as old as you, but I've been doing corporate IT for a long time, since at least the late 90s when I got out of high school and got my first internship at a Houston company called Questia, where I did all my growing at. Corporate IT does such a terrible job of dealing with user education. And a lot of it is because you have to take that lowest common denominator approach almost always, because management all
forces
you to. Well,
let's not blame it all on the corporations.
No,
let's completely blame it
on corporate IT, because the culture of corporate IT are the nerds. Initially, mm-hmm. it was that nerd mentality with that whole, you know, I am the keeper of the sacred knowledge, and you are too unworthy and stupid to understand
it.
In
the mainframe days, maybe that was a little justified.
Even in the early, and then in the early days of Windows computers on the desktop, your IT person was somebody who just couldn't be bothered. You know, it's like they wanted a network with no users on it. So the idea of educating users was beneath them.
Well, a lot of users don't. I mean, a lot of people see it, even though you've got a computer on your desk, you use a computer to do your job. That computer isn't necessarily, you know, it's central to your job, but figuring out, like, how to have a secure password won't help you make your reports any faster. It won't help you do whatever your real job is any faster.
I'm going to lay this at the feet of the developers, because you've got tools out there. Like, for instance, we've had encryption for email. We've had PGP for almost coming up on 20 years now.
Yeah, you ever use PGP?
Yeah, I have. And that's the whole point here. It's really tough. It's not something that, you know, your average person is going to be able to go out and just really figure out. You know, the same thing, you know, just something as simple as typing HTTPS into a URL, into a web browser, was really tough until a lot of sites like Facebook and Gmail, and you have plugins like HTTPS everywhere. But again, that included that would have to have someone being aware of that and going to install that extension. Mm-hmm. You know, until people did that, people couldn't even type in that extra S to encrypt, you know, their HTTP traffic.
What a note to.
That's the thing. I think it needs to get easier. Like, just like it's as easy to send a mail, it needs to be just that easy to do so securely. And that's falls back to the developer.
You have to force security onto the user.
The corporations don't have the tools to really do that. I mean, the best tools right now are enterprise tools, not for the public masses right now.
And the tools that you get in the enterprise often are less carrot and more stick.
Well, like, that's the only way you're going to get people to do it for the most part.
Yes, I mean,
though.
So look at something like like an organization's password policies, where, you know, a typical corporation will have, you've got to have a password that you log on with that's 16 characters, mixed case, one special character, and it expires every 90 days, and you can't reuse.
The 90-day thing is bad, but yeah.
You can't reuse the past, you know,
25,
yeah. So you can't just be like, you know, blah, 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 1, and then when it expires, you can't be like, blah, 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 2, and you can't do that because they've got it all figured out where you can't. All that does, like, when you crank down restrictions that high, rather than enforcing a sane password policy or giving the users options for two-factor or smart card authentication or something extra, is you make people get to where they just write their damn passwords down on Post-its and they leave them all over the place.
Well, a lot of that, yeah, well, that's the password rotation. And a lot of, hopefully there's a big movement saying don't rotate passwords, because that's exactly what it does. And really, if you're saying, hey, we're rotating passwords every 90 days, that's assuming, hey, you've got weak systems and we got broken into and we're going to, you know, kick them out after 89 days. You know, if you've got strong passwords, passphrases, you know, that are long enough, and especially if you're using two-factor authentication, there's no need to rotate those every 90 days.
Absolutely.
But a lot of it, it's just, you know, it's compliance is where we are with information security right now, and compliance is just a paper job, and it doesn't really get you anything in the real world. Mm-hmm. So that's what's got to change. Everyone kind of has to go on a little bit more of the offensive, and especially home users, you know, you've got to go beyond just running, you know, your antivirus and being a little bit safe, and, you know, y'all have to be aware too, I would think.
Everybody does. You should have, in my opinion, you should have login passwords on your home computer. You darn sure should have a password on your phone. If you've got a phone that you carry around with you, you absolutely should have that password protected.
And that's also the phone manufacturers are, you know, at least Apple, I know, is doing that from the get-go. You have to
have to do it. And you can use your thumbprint, which it works for some people. Mine works great. I know some people have problems with it for whatever reason. But if your phone doesn't have, I mean, you know, somebody breaks into your computer at home, and that's a lot of stuff to have to potentially sift through. But on your phone, you know, you've got really quick access to, I mean, if you're like most people, some people, I guess, don't put stuff on their phones. But generally, if you've got a smartphone, everything on it is stuff that is important and, you know,
accessible.
Needs to be kept secret.
Well, most people don't have, you know, so much stuff on their phone anymore, but they have the account and all the information,
that's
credentials
what, that's what
for
I mean.
All
yeah.
the cloud. You
well,
know, your
for sure,
email,
my phone
your pictures,
logs into my
everything.
Email.
Yeah.
So at the very least, I could then go, I've got access to your email. And I can go to the website
requesting
mm-hmm. password resets. It's going to come right there to the phone.
Yeah, to your banking software, to whatever else you happen to have installed on your phone that you use.
Right. Well, I hear Pete in the background.
Oh, hey there, Pete.
We did get him.
Hello.
Hello, Pete.
You are driving. That's awesome that you can Skype and drive.
Yeah.
And
no. I didn't.
Okay.
Didn't make it. Had one of those nightmare. The dog. I will tell you, has been silent. Up until now.
He started talking to you. He hears you talking and he wants to be a part of the conversation.
Hey there.
Yeah, he's not picking a good day for it. No, I had planned to come over for the show and had a small task. One thing I needed to get done today.
It's never just one
and,
thing.
No, it was just the one. It's just that one task then basically migrating, setting up an e-commerce, a Magento site, that's no big deal. It's already set up. But migrating product data into it from a CSV file, which should be pretty simple, except it's not. The CSV file has to be perfect, and this particular file they sent me has 16,000 inconsistent records in it.
Is this one of those deals where it's like six and one half and a dozen of the other, whether or not it's faster to manually fix it or to like spend the time to write a script, and it takes so long to write the script that you could have just manually fixed it in the first place?
Yeah, I'm very close to, if I knew this morning what I know now, I probably would have just dumped that CSV into a database and then written like a PHP script to take the data out of the database. Mm-hmm. And do whatever massaging and generate the CSV file that I ultimately need.
That's always the geek's dilemma. That's the fish or cut bait of the geek world. Do I fix it by hand or do I take six hours and write the script? And
XKCD, and we should put this up on the site at some point. They did an article or a little comic maybe about a year ago that actually took down, it was a chart, and it said like, hey, how long is it going to take you to, you know, like code this or script this or automate this? And then how many times, you know, do you do it a week or a year or a month? And how long does it take you? And it actually lets you, so you can look it up and you can say, hey, I do this, you know, once a month. It takes me 5 minutes to do it once a month, and it projected out over 5 years, and it said, okay, if you're going to do this every month for 5 years, it takes you 5 minutes, you can spend 4.5 hours automating it. Otherwise, you're wasting your time. And it's really cool, and yeah.
The struggle is real.
We will have to find that. So yeah, it's too much of a struggle. It's, at that point, you just like look up the chart, and the decision is made.
There's an XKCD for everything.
There truly
so,
is.
Well, so the sad part is, if I was not a diligent person and not, you know, really focused on this and working hard, I would have just blown it off about 2.5 hours, 3 hours earlier and driven over and done the show in person. But it's like, oh no, I'm just about there. You know, I'll finish this, and then then you're past that first moment when you would leave to go to the show, and then it's like, okay, well, if I can have this done by, you know, by four, I could make it, and then you run it, because basically Magento, you go to import this file, and I guess the best analogy, it's like the worst girlfriend that you ever had. You know something's wrong, but no one will tell you, and nothing tells you. You just know it's wrong. It just doesn't work. So error. Try again.
Just error.
PHP MyAdmin.
Try again.
If you're working with MySQL, PHP MyAdmin has a really, really robust importer to where I've thrown all kinds of files at it, and it seems to work around it and figure it out, and then you can just, you know, fish the data out of there.
See, the problem with Magento is Magento is complicated on the back end, and so it's got processes in between your CSV file and the back end, so it's not just MySQL kind of thing.
Or you spit it back out. Yeah, we do that a lot. We have to massage a lot of data, so sometimes it's just easier just to put it into something and then get it back out. Even
yeah,
especially
it's like
just
old school.
Up
it's like old
sets.
School debugging. You go yeah. look at it and try to figure out what's wrong with your CSV. So anyway, that just it is. It's one of those, you know, you focus so intensely to figure that out, and so the hours fly by, and you hit a point where you figure out that the path you're on is not going to work. You can't search and replace, or use your usual tools. So you have to start over again, almost from scratch. And I did that about 4 times on this thing. And you know, like I said, it's 16,000 records. It's the first file. There's more, but. Anyway, it just it doesn't make you a fun person to be around.
The XKCD comic is titled "Is It Worth the Time?" So Google search XKCD. Is it worth the time?
Well, see, it's so blown out. You know, how long would it take to enter 16,000 products into a web interface?
You're not key entering that. Yeah, that's something you Mechanical Turk, or you go adopt some children or something to have them do it.
Mechanical Turk.
An
some
entire
poor,
Chinese
some
orphanage.
College student do it for you. Yeah.
Interns.
So I heard the discussion sounded like it was about security.
Yeah, so. You had your lead story for your thing was going to be about, looked like it was going to be
the cyber criminals.
Bank hack. So you want to? How do we want to do that? Do we
all
wanna,
the hacks?
All the hacks.
Hack everything. Uh-huh.
Should we just knock out a quick news?
Why don't we knock out a quick news?
Let's do that.
Let's do it. Do we have?
Take it away, Info Shot.
Make it happen.
It's the Technology Bytes Info Shot. Technology news and commentary by Peter Hughes. Injected directly into your skull.
Yeah, so like we were talking about, a cyber criminal gang has plundered up to $1 billion from banks in at least 25 countries over the last 2 years. So it's not like, you know, it's not like the deal where over the weekend, you know, they burrow into the vault and take. No, they've been taking for years. Apparently, they've gotten a lot smarter. Kaspersky Lab reported this. They said that the gang penetrated deeply into the bank's networks, taking time to learn about the internal procedures so that their fraudulent activity would be less suspicious. In some cases, the gang learned about wire transfer systems by watching administrators' computers over video. So basically, it was like watching a screen tutorial of how to do whatever it was. So apparently, that way, when they made their moves and transferred stuff out, it looked legit, and it made it harder to stop. The group called Carbanic, Carbanak, after the malware the gang installed on computers, attempted to attack up to 100 banks and e-payment systems since 2013 in 30 countries. Gang members are suspected to be from Russia, Ukraine, other parts of Europe, and China. And the financial institutions affected are – it's not like – they didn't go for like the third world or something. Yeah, Bulgaria is listed in there in the Czech Republic, but so is the U.S., the U.K., Switzerland, Australia. So, you know, none of the financial institutions that were hit have been named. And, of course, the banks have been – quiet about it. Each theft took between 2 and 4 months, Kaspersky said. Bank computers would be infected with malware through spear phishing attacks, which involves sending targeted emails with malicious attachments or links to specific select employees. And the idea is they craft it so that that recipient thinks it really to them and open it and so on. As much as $10 million was stolen in a raid at a time. Funds were transferred using online banking or e-payment systems to the gang's own accounts or to other banks in the U.S. and China. Other times, the attackers had deep control within the bank's accounting systems, inflating account balances in order to mask thefts. For example, Kaspersky said that an account with $1,000 would be raised to $10,000 with $9,000 of it transferred to the cyber criminals. And this is the one that's the most kind of – if you were going to make a movie, this is the part where you can visualize the scene yourself. The gang commanded ATM machines to dispense money at a certain time where it just starts spitting the money out with accomplices ready to pick up the disgorged cash. So they watched people close enough that they could see when, I guess, a teller or a person, you know, a support person could make an ATM give out money without any, you know, you didn't have to put in a card or any of the other stuff, that it could, you could make an ATM hand out money. So and they did it. So that is pretty mysterious. The fact that it cost that much and the banks, I have a feeling that there's going to be a lot of questions about the security at these banks and a lot more thought about what are you going to do, how do you make this work so that you can protect yourself, because $1 billion, that adds up. You know, if this happens, you know, a few more times, that's some real money to a bank. Of course, to you and me, it's, you know, it's a lot more than that. But, and here, just to show how much competition there is in our broadband world, he said sarcastically, AT&T is going to bring gigabit, you know, its gigapower internet service to a new city. That's 1 gigabit per second for $70 a month. Well, where are they going to do that? Are they expanding the markets that have access to gigabit internet? No, they're going to do it in Kansas City where Google Fiber already is. So this makes another city where AT&T – basically the Google and AT&T – AT&T keeps going up to go head-to-head with Google in the places where Google Fiber is.
But, Peter – tell them the twist about AT&T's rollout in Kansas City.
Oh, yes. And the two-tiered pricing. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, here's a good one.
What a twist.
Sort of it's so extortionate. So basically they're matching Google Fiber's price, but for the free price, you pay a price, which the price is – or for the lower price, not free. The lower price, you pay a price. You let AT&T track your web browsing history. So
Live, actually. They're gonna throw packets on there a la what Verizon is doing.
Correct.
A little bit with
they're
some
going
global
to charge
ID.
You extra for you to have the privacy that you would expect to have naturally by having the service.
This is independent of your browser privacy settings, independent of your opt-out settings. This is all done at the head end. With your implied consent by choosing the lower competitive $70 a month rate.
Privacy has become a luxury item.
Yes.
And now, you have to pay $29 a month to opt out of the Internet Preferences program. AT&T says it tracks the web pages you visit, the time you spend on each, the links or ads you see and follow, and the search terms you enter. AT&T Internet Preferences works independently of your browser's privacy settings regarding cookies, do not track, and private browsing. If you opt into AT&T Internet Preferences, AT&T will still be able to collect and use your web browsing information independent of all those settings.
This just kills me. So, okay, so let's say you're a resident in Kansas City, and you know, somebody knocks on your door, and you open your front door, and standing there on your porch, there's like Google Fiber guy on the left, and he happens to have arrived at the same time as AT&T guy, and they're both there to sell you their services. And Google guy is like, hey man, we've got, since you live in Kansas City here, we've got gigabit internet, and we'll give it to you for $70 a month. And AT&T says, oh, wait a minute, we've got gigabit internet too, and we're AT&T, and we'll give it to you for $70 a month, but, you know, we're going to track everything that you do. But if you pay us another $30 a month, then we won't. And what is the value proposition that they're selling on? What
people probably don't
leg
check.
Are they standing
they
on?
Probably don't package it like that. And really,
well,
all of our information
would, yes, that would be a bad way to market your services.
Yeah, it's probably in the fine print. Just like, you know, they don't say like, hey, you know, you're not getting five statics. You're not getting, you know, synchronous up and down. You're not getting all this stuff with the business package. They just go, hey, here's the consumer package. It is what it is. And if you want this other stuff, you know, it's kind of buried. And you kind of have to go look for it. I'm assuming they're going to hide it like a free download.
Yeah, yes.
You know, that's what I'm thinking,
sure,
their plan's going to be.
But, I mean, the value proposition here that AT&T is offering is demonstrably – I mean, this isn't a case where you kind of need to make a pros and a cons column and, like, sort of list. This is, like, one of these options is clearly better than this other option, which is clearly terrible. I mean, you –
probably going to get some leverage, I guess, on consolidated billing, on people not knowing. And I'm sure that some executive just said, hey, you have to match Google, because that's exactly what they're doing. And questioned on, like, hey, where are you guys going to put it? AT&T said, well, we're going to have to do some studies and see where it's most cost effective and where
they
we
said,
get
just
the most
a second,
return.
Where's Google
they said,
putting
it? Exactly. That's what it comes down to. They looked towards Mountain View and took a breath.
It's just crazy, man.
Did you see the other big Kaspersky thing, Pete, when you were talking about the other story previous to this?
No.
Big, like, as far as, you know, like, hacker stuff goes and as far as malware goes, the two most valuable resources on the PC are going to be your BIOS. So you get in underneath the operating system. You know, you get something that before, you know, the computer, when it boots up and hands off to whatever is going to boot up finally, you know, you get your stuff in there. That's awesome. One of the second most valuable places is the disk drives. And so Kaspersky Labs, they're based out of Russia. They found some really, I guess, unique BIOS signatures on the hard drives that can be activated by, like, you know, going and loading up some other malware. And it's all over the place. It's on drives like Western Digital, Seagate, a lot of the big names. Now, the good news is most of these drives are being exported from the U.S. They're winding up in places like, you know, Iran and places, you know, that we could consider maybe, you know, us, we're hostile against them. I guess it's pretty expensive to do here in the U.S. But, yeah, that was just a day or two ago, and that's a really big deal, and it looks like it's been happening for a while. And so far, I think none of the manufacturers have fessed up to having any knowledge of it. Maybe they didn't. You know, who knows?
This is allegedly tied in with what everybody thinks. There's no solid information out here, but with what everybody thinks is a state-sponsored spying program with ties to the NSA by this group. So this whole Kaspersky was tied in. I know Ars Technica, we did an expose on it, and we also had there was another site that got the information that did a really good write-up on it. But this is all this stuff, this BIOS virus, there was another just incredibly...
The Equations Group is what you're thinking of? Yeah, so there's a few. So Kaspersky has like a few different, I guess, I don't even know what departments in there. And one of them is
it's way
called
more than
Great.
Just a company that makes antivirus that you install.
And the cool thing is they're national, so they are a Russian company, but they make their acronyms work. And I wonder if they have like different acronyms for different languages. But the U.S. version, the English version, is called Great. And more or less what they do is they go out and they try and find malware and they assign it to actors. And they try and like look at coding styles. They look at, you know, what packages were used. They look at, you know, a lot of different, you know, digital fingerprint things to try and identify who's writing the malware, where it's coming from, who's putting it out there. And that's exactly, you know, just what Lee said. It looks like it traces straight back to the NSA. It looks like, you know, we've been putting it on hard drives, shipping it all over the U.S. And it's like if people didn't want to buy U.S. gear before, wow, this is really going to hurt
and
sales.
And it's not just these, you know, viruses that embed themselves in hard drive firmware. It's actually this entire suite of extremely sophisticated malware that does various things. And interestingly enough, it shares a lot of elements with Stuxnet. In fact, a lot of this, a lot of the speculation from Kaspersky is that the group, that this equation group that was responsible for a lot of this, that, that this ties back to, was involved with educating the state actors that perpetuated Stuxnet in the first place, and that these guys are probably the masterminds behind it. But they have just through piecing together different software fingerprints, different ways these viruses act, Kaspersky sort of collaborated and pulled together a family of malware that has been traced back to this group. And this is sophisticated, crazy stuff. There is an application called Greyfish, for example, that they use to, it can be used to infiltrate Windows, take over Windows boot process and control on a process by process level, everything that Windows does. And these are all used potentially not for like the average, you know, hacking group wants to go infect a bunch of computers to make a botnet to do DDoS attacks. These are apparently tools that are used in conjunction with undisclosed, you know, zero-day.
Yeah, these are APT.
Things.
This is APT
this
land.
Is APT
what
type
what
stuff.
They're sitting on, these are toolkits that are as deep. Well, not maybe they're not as deep, but they are, you know, what a lot of nation states wish they had. You know, it's on par. Like, I would say, you know, maybe the next biggest toolkit like that would be, you know,
this
like
is,
what the
is
NSA is sitting
big
on.
This
CIA
is about
on.
As sophisticated as these kind of things can get. I mean, the stuff where, like, you watch the episode of, you know, whatever Hollywood crime show, and they have the computer episode, and they're all like, the hard drive has a virus in the firmware, and I'm hacking the firewall, and you're like, well, that's dumb. This is, like, stuff that's kind of on that level approaching, you know, really scary. But, I mean, the good news is, you know, there's the old adage that a state-sponsored actor who wants to hack you is going to hack you no matter what you can do. Normal people are not going to be the targets of groups like this, of tools like this. These are the kind of things that are used to infiltrate, you know, other, like, foreign governments and stuff. These are high-level intelligence-gathering type tools that you and I would, you know, you're not going to need to scan your hard drive's controller to find the firmware virus inside of it, because there's probably
and you wouldn't find it anyway. Yeah, for one, you wouldn't find it. You're going to have to get some
JTAG. There's not one because you're not working on nuclear secrets for the North Korean government. Well, I mean, unless you are working for nuclear secrets on the North Korean government, which case maybe there's.
Although the dangerous side of this is, you know, whatever the government comes out when they do backdoors and when they do things like that, you know, other people are going to emulate that. So,
absolutely.
You know, the NSA had, I think it was called the Wagon Bed Toolkit, which is more or less they, you know, tossed a little bitty tiny cell phone in the backs of the servers, and they wired them in such a way that they could see, you know, all the memory of the server. And then, you know, they could just make a phone call and say, hey, here's what's going on with this, and do all kinds of control stuff. Something dropped.
You guys okay
microphone.
In there?
Microphone. Just drop the mic, walk away. Yeah, this isn't going to go away, is the point.
Nope.
I guess we've kind of beat this into the ground a little bit.
But you should still, even though you are probably not the target of state-sponsored hacking, you should still use passwords and try to secure yourself, because remember, if you find yourself in a dragon's cave with a hungry dragon and a hobbit, you don't have to outrun the dragon.
Well, yeah.
You just have to outrun the hobbit.
That's the whole point. It's just like the wagon bed stuff. Other hackers are seeing what the NSA is doing, and criminals are seeing what the NSA is doing, and they're replaying those same attacks.
And unless you're doing something and making yourself a target of state-sponsored hacking or high-profile stuff, your goal with keeping yourself secure is not to make yourself totally armored against all attack, because you can't. No one can. But you do want to be a little more secure than the guy next door who's like, I don't need a password on my Wi-Fi. I don't need a password on my phone. You know, that, because when it comes to casual attacks, he'll get hit and you won't. Man.
Well, a couple other last things on the news. If you're one of the people who bought a Microsoft Surface,
I've seen a couple in the wild.
they're out there. I figured that our listeners, that there would be odds that some of them might have them. If there's an opportunity for you to trade in your Microsoft Surface, your original one, towards a new Surface Pro 3.
Which is not bad hardware, frankly. I mean, it's not a bad piece of kit.
You know, so basically the deal is, you know, the Surface lineup is down to a single model. The Surface Pro 3 has replaced all the previous ones. The Surface 2 isn't being manufactured. You know, the thing is, though, the older hardware is going away and is not going to be supported, and so you may want to go with something a little better. It's got, let's see, there's a new one coming after that. There's always another one coming, but at least you can, between now and March 8th, you can look this up and find the, it's called CEX Change, CEX, and then the word change, has a trade-in site where you can send your Surface tablet and receive credit towards a new one.
What's that site again, Peter?
CEX.
Change.
is the name of the company. Okay. So, yeah, so I don't know. That's I'm sure they thought it was a great idea when they named the company, but so that's an opportunity where you can make that, you know, obviously the secondary market, Craigslist, I'm not thinking there's a lot of Surface, Microsoft Surface is selling for big bucks on Craigslist, so you may want to see what you can get from them.
I go to CE Exchange every year, and I look up my answers on Experts Exchange.
Is that at the adult CES that happened?
CEX in Vegas. It goes every year.
I don't think it's actually at the same time anymore. I think they do it on like a different week now.
They do, which is odd.
On a positive security front, Apple is expanding two-step verification to iMessage and FaceTime. You know, we talked, you know, in the security part before this, and, you know, during the news we talked about two-step verification so that you aren't just dependent on your password and that. And if somebody gets a hold, for instance, your phone, if they get a hold of your iPhone, now you can make your iMessage and FaceTime more protected so that the person who shouldn't have it has an even tougher time to get at your stuff. Yep. And so, you know, it's a positive step, and so I wanted to mention that one. And then finally, on the just like weird news, there's a report that Apple has several hundred staffers building an electric car. The Wall Street Journal reported this. So this isn't even like some flaky, you know, blog in the middle of nowhere where the guy just, you know, makes up stuff about Apple. The Wall Street Journal cited people familiar with the matter in describing a project named Titan. And while the report acknowledged the possibility such a car might never see release or take years to launch, its sources claimed that the specific people put onto the Titan project, including former Ford engineer and current Apple product design vice president Steve Zadesky, were a sign that, quote, the company was serious.
You know, my wife showed me an Onion article that parodied that announcement, and it said that one of the features of the Apple car is that when the car stalls, the hubcaps will be like spinning rainbow pinwheels so that you can see that the car is stalled.
Somebody said, I saw a tweet about the Apple car and said he was going to wait for the Mac truck.
It's supposed to resemble a minivan. So that's interesting.
I'm out. Never mind.
The stories began to break on Monday of this week thanks to a Business Insider report that quoted an unsolicited email from an Apple staffer about the company hiring engineers away from Tesla to work on vehicle development. Although that report didn't go so far as to claim the reason was a brand new car.
It's a brand new car!
Rather, Mac Observer made that assertion a day later thanks to the site's, quote, own sources. The news comes roughly a year after Tesla founder Elon Musk confirmed that he had held conversations with Apple, but he wouldn't confirm anything about plans or suggestions that his company be acquired. So that was the other rumor that's, I believe, Daring Fireball had that next year that Apple's just going to pay cash and buy Tesla outright.
Yeah, no.
I don't think Musk is selling.
No, Musk isn't selling. Although, after the earnings call, what is Apple's cash reserve at this point? $180 billion.
Yeah, they could buy everything.
They could literally build like a stack of money that goes to the moon and back at this point. Just for no reason, just to do it. Just be like, we can't spend money fast enough, so we just literally made this pillar of $100 bills that goes to the moon.
I bet Apple makes minivans.
They actually passed Android as far as sales. I think in the U.S., they have a larger percentage of the market than, you know, they got past 50% again.
Well, Well, the majority of their growth came out of China. I mean, they're just rocking it in developing markets, and good for them.
That's amazing, given that, you know, think about it. In the life of this show, there was the, you know, remember when Michael Dell said that Apple should basically go out of business and refund the money to its shareholders?
Yes, famously.
That that's what he would do.
Well, what did Michael Dell end up doing with his company?
I guess he borrowed money and gave and bought off his shareholders. But, you know, the stock was down to like $18 a share at one point.
Oh yeah, well there was that famous Wired cover, the Apple logo with the crown of thorns around it and the word pray, and that was in, I think that was June of 97. It's probably the most famous Wired magazine cover that they've ever done. And that was it. I mean, Apple was posting billion-dollar losses every quarter back then. It's difficult, especially for new folks who didn't live through, you know, kind of the 90s era of Apple.
The lean years.
To reconcile, like, the Gil Emilio, like, oh my God, what's going on years. And back then, I mean, I don't think very few people who use computers today seriously, especially guys who use Linux and stuff, now on Macs, used Macs back then. I mean, that was I just don't think that was. I mean, I certainly didn't back in the 90s when I was in junior high and high school or whatever. We were PC wall to wall and all through Windows 95, Windows 98, through Windows XP. I mean, I didn't make the shift until after Apple jumped to Intel, the Intel platform.
Well, Apple computers were for print production and graphic arts type stuff.
It was always big in the art world, is what I always thought. Yeah.
They were
and
toys.
And colleges, too.
They were toys.
They were toys for artsy people.
I think U of H got a ton of free Apples because there were Macs, like, all over, and
all the
free computers were Macs.
In the Honors College computer lab at U of H where I went, we had Windows NT boxes.
I did that, but I hung out on Jetson and Bayou. I hung out on the Vax cluster.
I remember them having Macs at the Kinko's for doing you could rent time on the Mac and to do your artwork.
Did it have a big 17-inch monitor?
Yeah, we did the album cover for one of our albums. You know, we took the artwork, we scanned it, we brought it into Photoshop, and we were working with this giant file and editing it. And just, they made their money off of us because the computer was slow.
Well, yeah, in the 80s at A&M, they had, they had some Macs and then the PC lab, and frankly, one of the reasons I got into the Mac stuff was because the Macs were always empty. You could walk into that lab when it was just packed and everybody's, you know, it was like Lord of the Flies over in the PC part of the lab, and the Macs are all empty. Nobody was using them, and so I bought myself some 3.5-inch floppies, and which is what you had at the time, or 3.5-inch disks, and started, you know, writing my papers and doing stuff on the Macs.
Oh, I did my share of flame wars in the early 90s, mid 90s on the local BBS scene, and when I got into Usenet on flaming Usenet about, you know, Apple sucks and Mac sucks and their toys and all that. And looking around the studio here, it's MacBook Air, MacBook Air, MacBook Air, MacBook Air in the control room. Yeah, I mean, it's everybody has switched. Personally, I switched because it's a great platform. It's got Unix with a great GUI, and I can dual boot Windows and play games. And I mean, that's pretty much it. I switched in 2007. I was not happy with how Vista was going. I didn't like the fact that my fancy SLI equipped rig had crashy video drivers that wouldn't work right, and it just was all. I just didn't like it. Oh, sorry.
I had a
get closer to the mic here.
I had
sorry,
all
guys.
those reasons, plus another reason. So yeah, you know, I grew up messing with PCs, and you know, you weren't a real computer person unless you had to like set your IRQs by hand because you stuck
That's right.
stuff in it.
If you didn't have
and it didn't
three
work.
AutoExecBat and ConfigSys files and a Bash
one
file to
gaming.
Switch between them, one for XMS, one for EMS, and one for maximum conventional memory for doing something else, I think. I don't remember.
QEMM
386 and MemMaker. Yeah, I'm sorry. So, yes, continue.
So I was in that camp, and, you know, I hated Macs. And then they struck me as curious, though, because they had an interesting design aesthetic, but I wasn't interested in them. And then I went to work, and I ended up taking over the guy who was doing the computer modeling for space station components, and he had been on a Mac. So in order to take over his job, I had to take the Mac. And I quickly realized, like, while I just did my work and everything worked, all these people that I worked with around me that had PCs kept having network problems and trying to print to the printer problems and all kinds of problems. And I think it was running 9X. It may have been 8X. But anyway, it was running. It was okay, but I still wasn't a huge fan other than, wow, these things actually are reliable.
You
like,
know,
that's
it
cool.
Probably worked because you had to have a special, like, AppleTalk network set up just so you could print, so you were the only one who was using it, and it worked great.
So, but I still wasn't interested because they were expensive, and, you know, I was still a PC person. Although I was a Unix person by that point in time, I was really into Unix as well. So then I ran FreeBSD at home, and then it was kind of a mixture of things. I actually had a job and I made money, so apples weren't
donate to KBFT
weren't unaffordable
had,
to me.
Had a job, made money.
You know, so it wasn't like I couldn't afford an apple anymore because they were
expensive.
They were pricier.
Oh yeah.
But also, yeah, they announced OS X, mm-hmm. which was Unix, and you know. Apple does have a really nice aesthetic, a nice interface. Mm-hmm. Their hardware looks nice. Oh, excuse me. And so, yeah, it was kind of one of those points where I was like, I got to the point where I was like, look, I've got the money.
And
I don't
like
want to set
this.
IRQs. It's nice
neat.
Looking. The GUI's really is nice.
And I can
drop to a terminal anytime I want. Like, yeah, I'll do that.
You can bring up Bash whenever you want. And yeah.
See, I'm in the opposite. Well, or not. Basically the opposite starting story because I've always been on Macs. I actually have never purchased I purchased a Dell that had Windows on it, and that was because it was a Dell Mini 9 and I turned it into a Hackintosh. But otherwise it's Macs as far as the eye can see. I had a Newton, not the early ones that sucked. I had a Newton 2000 that was a real hint at what the awesomeness of the iPhone was going to be. And so we could have had a lot of this stuff a lot sooner if Steve Jobs hadn't punted the Newton project. But, you know, the thing that struck me in the 90s, I as like many other people, ended up with a decent job because of the Internet, at a big company, and then had the money to buy hardware. And so I bought a laptop. I bought an Apple laptop. The thing is, I brought it with me, and the striking thing to me was I traveled. You know, I was doing projects kind of all over the place. I was traveling to New York, and I was traveling to Europe and stuff like that. And the thing that was funny is at the local networks, at the corporate networks, I could hook up. Other people who would travel with me had their, like, Windows laptops from work, and they couldn't work on the network. But my Mac... Plug in the Ethernet cable, and off you go.
Yep. All right. Well, there's the music that's telling us that we need to.
The music.
We need to take care of some station business. So we're going to take care of some station business.
TCB.
Good conversation so far in the first hour of Technology Bites. I'm going to take this short break and be right back with another hour. If you want to participate, 713-526-5738. You're listening to Technology Bites. I'm Jay Lee.
I'm Peter Hughes.
I'm Flicted.
I'm Barrett.
I'm Lee.
And he's...
Groovehouse.
This is V. Patel, Vice Chair of the KPFT Local Station Board.
And I'm General Manager Dwayne Bradley.
And this is Dwayne Lark, Chair of the Local Station Board.
This announcement is about a vacancy on the Local Station Board.
And this is a great opportunity for us to increase the diversity on the board.
I agree.
Well, now that we have them interested, let's tell them how to apply.
Interested KPFT members should submit a letter of interest and have a willingness to attend the March 11th LSB meeting, during which candidates can speak to their qualifications.
Your application should consist of a short bio, your qualifications to serve on the board, as well as ideas to assist the board in accomplishing its duties.
Submission of interest by KPFT members should be emailed to lsb@kpft.org no later than March 4th. forth, please.
For more information about the LSB, go to kpft.org.
Thanks for supporting your local community radio station, KPFT Houston.
Did you know you can find KPFT on the social networking sites Twitter and Facebook? You certainly can, and we'd love you to add us as a friend and get us connected with friends of yours. Join our fan page and check out a special video message from General Manager Dwayne Bradley, as well as keep up with KPFT programmers and staff. Visit facebook.com/KPFT Houston to join us. To follow us, visit twitter.com/KPFT. With both, you can link up with other KPFT listeners, get the latest news about the station, and find lots of extras. It's fun, so catch up with KPFT online. Again, on Twitter, visit twitter.com/KPFT. On Facebook, visit us at facebook.com/KPFT Houston. This is commercial-free, listener-sponsored Pacifica Radio, 90.1 KPFT Houston.
You're listening to 90.1 KPFT Houston.
Welcome back to Technology Bites. And I see Pete has gotten up from his desk and wandered off. I see his exercycle in the background and what could be a tube television. That was a old projection
or
TV.
A tube top.
Ew. So we were talking about, when we went to the break, we were talking about
Apple history.
About
history.
And our history with Apple. So
spotty, but now good.
I did Apple in the 80s, like I think 1980.
I had an Apple too, but it didn't work very well. But
yeah.
The reason I switched to Apple is I just got really tired of not knowing how to use one.
So you had an old Apple, like early, like Apple II?
So no, I never owned my, I had a really good friend where I grew up in Colorado, and his dad worked for Lockheed. So in his basement, he probably had $50,000 worth of computer gear.
Which is
so he had really old
now.
Apple gear. So we actually, all the games, the good games, you know, because the other stuff, that there was like the first Atari was out, Pong was out at the time. This was, you know, 1980, 1981.
Lode Runner.
Yeah. So to play the good games, which were still monochrome, you know, so-so games, we had to, you know, get on an Apple and you had to like, you know, take the catalog and rerun the game. And to get more games, we would even, you know, like punch the 5 1/4 discs and, you know, like make double-sided discs. And the whole thing was, this was shareware back when shareware was passed around by hand. So his dad would be going to the office. These were all these other computer engineers. A lot of them would write games. And, you know, they'd bring them home. And then his dad would go out and we would get on probably what may or may not have been, you know, classified kind of computer system. We would get down there. We'd get around the lock. We'd power it up, put in, you know, get around the disk locks. And we'd play games all weekend.
See, I had one friend that had a TI-994A, one friend that had a TRS-80. And a couple of friends that had Commodore 64s. I had a Commodore 64.
Yeah, the VIC-20, but it wasn't...
I don't think
like
I had any friends
awesome.
That had Apple II, or
no,
C.
Those
any
were
those.
Pretty expensive even, then, I think. I mean,
oh,
I'm,
yeah. Yeah, one of the... Well,
I know the Apple IIe was like listed around $850, and that was like $1984. So, I mean, that's pretty pricey.
The IIe was the one of the last ones. It was one of the big ones, right? And then, of course, the Mac, when the Mac launched, the original Mac, it launched at $2,499, $2,500, something like that.
That's about right, yeah.
Yeah.
And that was no hard drive. That was just a single floppy.
Yes, there was a hard drive available, a profile hard drive in, I think, either 5 meg or 10 meg flavor, and it, 10 megabyte flavor, and it was like $3,000. And the other big accessory for the Mac at launch was the LaserWriter, which I think was like $8,000.
Yeah, I could afford none of that. My first real computer was bought from Radio Shack. I think it was like a 286 with the Mathco processor. This is a Tandy.
Mathco!
Yeah, they made stuff. And it wasn't all that expensive either.
I forgot. I had a friend,
20 megs hard
I had
drive.
A friend that had a Timex Sinclair.
I'm sorry.
Those
remember,
are cool.
Remember the
yeah.
little, it was
sorry
like
for
that
friend.
Mnemonic keypad little, yeah. It was. He had a tape drive that he had hooked up to it, so he could load stuff off of it.
Yeah, we were all PCs at my house. My dad brought one home from work so that he could ostensibly, I guess, so that he could work from home. But I don't think he ever used it. It was all me.
We all almost had a Coleco Atom.
Almost. I didn't even know that was a thing.
Yeah, so Coleco made a computer called the Atom. The interest. So the thing is, it was a kit, which is why my parents were kind of considering because you got one box that had everything. It had the computer and the monitor and a printer.
But it was. But you had to build it. It was a kit.
No, the crazy thing
you
was.
You say kit. I think like it's like an altar. Like you got to take it out of the box and like make.
No,
the computer.
It was late enough that it was pre-built.
Okay.
But it was by Coleco, who went on to do ColecoVision and all that stuff, right? But the funny thing is, I didn't notice at the time, but years later, it's like they put the power supply in the printer, and so everything was powered off the power supply that was in the printer.
Okay.
So if the printer died, then nothing else. Everything you couldn't else. Use anything else.
I just like the fact that they actually put in, you know, where like modern computers now, they've got, you know, floppy drives in the front. They actually had, you know, a tape drive smacked up there, just, you know, like a hi-fi system.
Not like a backup tape drive.
Yeah, the VIC-20 and the Commodore 64s I had a serial
cable. Have, like, removable drives on them? What? I'm an Apple owner. My machines have no drives.
There's
no optical. You know, there are kids now who the only laptops they've ever seen have two USB ports.
Oh yeah, yeah. That save icon with the 3.5-inch floppy disk on it. Nobody knows what that means anymore.
It's a save icon. That's
yeah,
all
it means,
is.
It means save. I'm not sure why it's a square. It just means save.
And you give them a disk, give them a DVD with software on it, and they're like, "Well, I don't know. There's no slot on this iMac."
All right, here's a question. Apple is about to announce the actual release of the Apple Watch.
Yes.
So here comes the Apple Watch.
They said on the earnings call, it'll be in April.
Okay. So does that mean in the next version of the Mac OS, they're going to reintroduce the little watch timer? Wouldn't that be cool? Little Apple Watch that shows what's on your Apple Watch as it spins and it.
I think it's still there. I think applications can call it, and it'll pop up every once in a while, because I know I've seen it.
What is it?
You remember how the activity icon...
Yeah, the wait icon.
The wait, when you were waiting for something to happen on your Mac, it would pop up a little clock or a little watch with a time, you know, the clock hand spinning around on it?
I'm sure Peter remembers.
It looked like a little bit. It didn't have a wristwatch band.
Yeah, it was a wristwatch. And it would come up, and it was a little activity monitor to let you know that the computer was thinking.
It was doing something?
Yeah.
That was before Apple got fun and went to the beach with a nice, you know... colorful
but
ball.
Now I'm thinking they can bring a color watch that actually shows information that's displayed on your actual Apple Watch.
No, they don't want to do that. That brings negative connotations to your Apple Watch. You don't want to associate your Apple Watch with, like, I got to wait for my stupid computer.
But they may want you to associate waiting with buying their product.
While you're waiting, why don't you?
Because people do that, don't they? They stand in line, camp out.
Did you guys see some of the speculation on how much the 18-karat gold version of the Apple Watch is going to cost? There is going to be, so they're saying there's going to be, at the high end, for people
18?
who are watch people, there will be an 18-karat gold
version.
Isn't
18 really soft, though?
I was just reading. It's on, there's a Daring Fireball link right now, among others. This is not an 18-karat gold coating. This is an 18-karat gold, like, the whole thing is 18 karat.
Oh, that's
gold.
Not bad. 5K.
Yeah,
that's a cheap, nice watch. I mean, people
grand.
Will drop 20K on a
that's
watch.
That's the
this.
Thing, though. I mean, you talk about dragging margin. That's going to be, you know, the price of gold being what it is, it's not, like, going to be, you know, ridiculous or anything. But that's a huge amount of money, and that's going to contribute, especially if, you know, watch guys jump all over this.
That is a tough purchase only because, you know, you get, put in brand of nice watch here. You get a Cartier. That's timeless, you know, and it's, you know, 50 years from now, it's going to be an antique watch.
What good is a watch if it's timeless?
This one's going to be timeless. This is something that's going to die. The battery's going to go. It's going to be obsolete. It's going to be, if anything, a museum piece or a novelty piece.
Right. Yeah.
You're going to wind up melting down the gold. I mean, that's probably the most redeeming value of this whole thing is at the end of it. Maybe it's got some.
It has intrinsic metallic value. Well, nobody
you can
has
add
done,
it to your stack.
I've used a bunch of the different smartwatches, mostly the Android Wear stuff, although I've used a couple of other ones, the Qualcomm Talk and some of the weird outliers.
Do you ever Pebble?
And I've used the Pebble. Maybe my standards are just higher, or maybe I'm just not looking to wear a computer on my wrist, but they're all terrible.
Yeah.
Apple has got a lot of convincing to do if they want, not like I'm some kind of paragon of consumerism that must be convinced to buy all products, but they got a long ways to go if they want to convince me that their watch is going to be worth buying, because so far nobody's done it
well,
right.
Well, I'm assuming you're in my camp. I want someone to make a compelling watch. I want something to be awesome enough to where
like,
I want to put it
yes,
on my
Yes, I would
wrist,
like
you know?
A reason to want to go have one. I want
I
to
want,
be wow.
Wow.
not echoing.
No, that's how wow he is. He's so...
I'm double wow. Whoa.
What does it all mean?
I did that.
Double rainbow.
What does it mean? No, but I want that. I want a company to make me want to buy into it, like Apple did with the smartphone, which I didn't really care about for iPhones. I was, because smartphones before iPhones were all like trios and things that were, you know, I guess some people liked them, but they were terrible. And smartwatches are kind of the same way.
It seems like to me that the watch is overpriced, but I don't have a big demand for it. In fact, about the only thing that Apple's come out with that I watched it and they got to the price point, other than like they released their OSs for free, which is pretty nice. But as far as hardware, the only thing that they ever did that they got to the price point and they set it, and I was like, okay, that's lower than I thought. Like that was the original MacBook Air. Like when they got to the end and they actually said the pricing was like $1,700, I think.
Oh, when,
that's
like
still
original,
too rich for my blood.
The original
though,
MacBook
the
Air.
One.
I was actually surprised because I thought it was going to be like $2,100, $2,400, something
I
like
thought
that.
The Mini was the first Apple product that I ever saw priced where I was like, okay, I would buy that with my own money, which I never did. Or the iPod Shuffle. That's more my price point. I've never actually bought my own Apple laptop. That's something I would have to
drop that on the pavement for a dollar.
Yeah. If it were my own money, I would really have to think tough about dropping, you know, upwards of $1,000 or $2,000 on a laptop. That'd be tough to do.
You know, I mean, they last forever. Although I noticed, we talked about this last week, yours is old, because you don't have a light-up keyboard like me and Jay do.
No. And actually, the work got me a new, I think it was a MacBook Pro, and I was like, nope, send it back. Because it's red right now. They're going to refresh it here in a month.
So I was
like, I don't really want it. I know I probably ruffled some stuff. It's like, hey, this is, here you go, you know, thanks for all the
but
whatever.
But that's
I'm
normally
like, no.
When you get stuff.
Well, I told him, I'm like, no, I'm not going to do it. I'm not going to be made fun of for another year and a half for not having
that almost has to happen, though. Like, in order for the new one to, they're going
to
delay
it
because you didn't take
they
it.
They tried to make it happen.
They're going
to
delay the release because you didn't take this one.
Barrett saw a shadow, and yeah.
It's a new computer.
6 more weeks of no new gear.
All right,
Barrett.
So where are we at in our lineup? I had
Do
to
we
kill
have,
him.
There's no Barrett time.
There's no Barrett time.
We have weird science, though, huh?
Science!
We also have try, buy, or fry.
All right.
Science! Okay, never mind. I just like saying that.
Okay, well, we'll do try, buy, or fry first.
Okay.
Got a few interesting ones. This one, I think I'd heard about it earlier, but it looks like they're a lot closer to like really being out. Have you heard of the swipe card, SWYP? Basically, it replaces all the like credit, debit, gift, and loyalty cards in your wallet with one card-sized and shaped device that it's made of metal. And it has a little screen on it. So what happens is it comes with a card reader that you hook up to your computer, or you hook up to it, and you swipe your card actually through, and it basically clones your cards to this card. And so you have one card, and when you go to the store and you want to select what card you use, it's got a little screen on it, and it's got arrow buttons, and you push the button until the card that you're wanting to use shows up. It shows the last four digits, and then you swipe it through or put it in an ATM or whatever, just the same as a regular card.
Does it have ancient elfin writing on it that glows when you use it?
By moonlight only.
I cannot read the fiery numbers.
And it's about $50.
I like that it has pin and chip, and I like that, you know, when I do, if I ever decide to go down the avenue of being an identity thief, that this would be the card I'd want, because it makes it really easy. I don't have to go online, buy specialized equipment.
Scan it,
I just,
and then immediately go
I
use it.
Yeah, I go get a job at a restaurant somewhere, you know, keep this, you know, in there, and boom, boom, here you go. Thank you very much. And yeah, I'm good to go.
I think on the card, it's only tied to, it has to, you have to set up the card where it's got your name. And so the cards that are swiped into it have to match on that or
I
something.
I think there's a way around that, though. But I do like the fact that it's pin and chip, which I think all the cards and all the credit cards in the U.S. have to go to that by fall.
In October, October 2015, I believe.
Which is really good, because I've had two credit cards now cloned. Like, actually, people made a card with a magnetic stripe in the last 2 months. Like,
oh, wow.
Yeah, I was really surprised. I actually went and tracked them this last time. I know what bars they go to. One of them is a really, really rough Nortenio bar, so I don't think I'm going to go find them. I thought I was at first. And then I did some Googling and did some pictured, you know, doing on street maps. I'm
like, they can have that credit.
They're going to see me coming from a mile away, and it's not going to end well. So, yeah, I just called the bank
instead.
They're
going to have more of your identity when they're
going to have a little less identity to steal.
DNA samples.
Well, essentially, I mean, that's what this card is, basically, where you can clone your own cards, which, I don't know. The nice part is, think about all those, you know, if it was a little bit cheaper, all those, like, store identity cards that you have, you know, Best Buy loyalty card or your Kroger card or whatever, you could put all those on it and you're not really risking anything, and you can replace, you know, 5 or 6 cards that you carry around in your wallet with one.
Yeah, but if I lose it, I'm out $50.
Does it also have a calculator?
That's true.
Nope. You know, a lot of those credit card, wallet, credit card size calculator? Oh.
Do you guys
they're trying
key
to be
card?
Sort of the Apple of fake credit cards, I guess, because they've got a pretty nice look on it. If you go to Uncrate, it should be on one of the first couple pages.
So you're saying that also that doesn't manage rewards cards, though, right? This is just more or less payment cards, gift
anything
cards.
With anything with a stripe.
I think it said reward cards.
Okay, that's kind of cool.
Credit, debit, gift, and loyalty card.
Oh, gift
loyalty.
And loyalty.
Okay,
yeah.
Loyalty, yeah. There you go.
So you said it could include a chip and pin?
Yeah, it's going to have a pin and chip on it, which if you've traveled to the UK or if you've traveled anywhere else, and this is what it comes down to, is that, you know, if I were to grab, like, Lee's credit card right now, and, you know, I could go online
put my
and get
credit
a
card down, Barrett,
I could go get a, you know, like a little blank that's, you know, looks like a real credit card and probably match the colors to Lee's bank, or it doesn't even really matter anymore at that point. And, you know, for like $50-$100 I can get a magnetic stripe, you know, reader and encoder, and, you know, and but the main thing is a lot of these cards, the way you can tell a fake card is a lot of them aren't embossed. Like, they just, you know, paint or print out the numbers on the card. They don't actually have that raised part, although that's getting fairly easy to do now too. So the idea is, really, at this point, the idea that, you know, if you have physical possession of your card, that's all you need, that breaks down, because if I get the information off this magnetic strip and I get the numbers off the card, it's very trivial for me to make a card that acts just like that, behaves just like that. ATMs don't know the difference. No one knows the difference. So with pin and chip, what they're doing, and did you actually have one?
I have
card?
One, but now I was going to point out that the chip and pin, I call them chip and pin, you're calling pin and chip.
Fish and chips.
Whichever.
The chip and pin card also contains a magnetic stripe.
No, it still does, yeah.
So it can be used either way.
Because they have to be backwards compatible.
That was mainly for backwards
US.
Compatibility, yes. But right. The new readers will also go in and look at the chip, and that's, you know, yes. It's got a layer of encryption in it. It's extremely hard to counterfeit. And then combined with the fact that it's not only something you have, it's something you know. So just like an ATM card, you're still going to have to put in a code. It makes it a lot tougher to clone cards and get by in the real world with a stolen card.
Mm-hmm. And I did, I mean, when I was in Germany last month, I had to use my card at a couple of different places.
They've got to do a special job for that. They roll their eyes and they pull.
At the hotel I was at, I was staying at a big Hilton, and so they didn't have any trouble with it. But I had to buy a little SIM card at the airport at one of the little SIM card shops, and it was like I pulled my little American card out, and they were like, "Oh, man, don't go to put it in the reader and like wait and like it yeah."
But here's what's also cool about the way that they manage credit cards overseas in Europe is, even if you're going to use a magnetic strip, the weight person or the staff person comes to you with the reader.
Yes.
And
they
scan it right in front of you. They take your card, they scan it, they give it back to you. That card is never out of your sight. They don't go wander off back behind a counter and do whatever. So you see them, you know, they'll put it on the table, let you swipe it yourself.
Yeah, that's actually really cool. That was kind of a fun experience at first, like getting to pour your own pint. And that's what bothers me is that mine had to have been taken, like I don't use my card at very many places, so it was either, you know, at a place where they were very good, where I handed it over and, like, you know, maybe at a drive through and they just swiped it and gave it right back and it was done. Or I'm thinking, and I always check, I don't use random ATMs, but I do use my, or I was using my card to get gas, and I'm thinking, you know, that the scanners, that the card skimmers are getting so thin and so good that I was not able to detect this. Because I usually I'll shine a flashlight, I'll
actually,
steer
some
around.
Of the gas stations, they'll actually break into them and put the scanner inside.
Something
so
had to be on the inside because that's one thing I do check. I mean, I will check, and I've seen
lift,
a couple in the wild, and I pull them out.
Grab a clutch out of them and see if anything's loose.
Yeah,
or
yeah, that's
around.
Usually the thing. It is. Or shine a light up in there, you can see a double lip or something. But this, whatever I put my card into, was good enough to where I couldn't tell.
Was this your debit card or your credit card?
This was, sadly, it was my debit card because,
okay,
like
so
I said, the
bad.
Other one, it is bad because I was using that because my credit card, like I said, within 2 months, two cards.
Had already been,
so yeah, that was canceled. So I'm like, I'm either going to put it on my, the only other thing I have is my corporate card. And I can't really
can't
do that. So.
Yeah, I don't even
want to answer that. Barrett, we're looking at your statement here.
Yeah.
Why were you at this bar on the corporate card last
night?
Well,
that was, I mean, the only time that I've ever had my credit card information stolen was in Germany, which is weird.
The Germans.
And I only used that credit card in a couple of places.
They'll give us your credit card.
Fortunately, the people who stole the credit card number only went after some weird $25 charges on some different sites.
Yeah, mine, they made, apparently, whoever stole mine, they do them well enough to afford a Cadillac because they made some Cadillac payments.
I've
online.
Never had.
They did a lot of stuff. I was like, all within about a day.
Now you understand how they can afford them when you drive through some neighborhoods where they the houses are not very nice, but the cars are all
I hope
new.
They got some Buchanan vanity plates on there. That's all I hope.
Do you have any ability to track who stole it because of that?
That's what I've been, I'm without saying a whole lot on air. Okay. I've been working with some people that we see in the shadows every once in a while.
Darknet.
In Vegas.
Are you using the darknet?
I'm doing nothing illegal or whatever.
Are you using
but
Tor?
I am curious about what they're doing, so I've got some friends kind of peering in on things.
Tracer T.
Tracer T.
Pin G is the tool of choice. Really.
Did you write a Visual Basic GUI?
I was thinking about it. We'll see. I think they're all coming from Google. I think Google's hacking me.
In Try, Buy, or Fry, the swipe card looks interesting.
I would buy it because for $50, you're getting a card reader and encoder, and that's pretty cheap.
I
bet that gets hacked and people start to do fun stuff with it pretty soon.
I would only try it if they did a marketing tie-in with Swiper from Dora the Explorer.
Swiper, no swiping, except with this.
Only Swiper, it's okay to swipe this.
I don't know.
Swiper more swiping.
I like having multiple cards. I hate the thought of losing everything at once.
That's really scary. Yeah. One card.
There's something that's just
got to be a
remote
kill on it.
I think if
it.
You haven't used it, you have to put in a pin or there's something.
I mean, is there a security on the card itself that allows
you?
Okay. I would try it if they want to send me a review copy, but I'm not going to buy one right now.
Yeah, I would put that in the try category.
As it goes along, that'll be one of those as people use it and you hear. I would definitely be under the try category too. You think about it though, if it does work, then your wallet, all those different cards, when you could have basically a leather iPhone case and just have a card slot on the back. So you put the card in with the phone and just keep all your precious together.
Have you seen any benefit of something like this over, say, Apple Wallet or Apple Pay?
You can use this everywhere.
Google Wallet.
The swipe card you can use on
traditional
credit
card.
Anything that takes a magnetic strip where the Apple Pay is limited to where they.
So do you actually put the swipe card into things?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's
you dial in whatever
card.
There's a little menu on it, and you pick the card that you're going to use. And it shows you the last four digits and the expiration date.
But does it actually do it as the magnetic strip?
Yeah, the
magnetic strip
realigns, and then you swipe it.
However, having seen there's a really cool, I forget what it is. Is it some credit card company makes a really cool metal card that I was like, that's so awesome. It's you feel like if ninjas.
I think
attack
it was
you,
the American Express.
Something. Yeah, no, I thought that card was super super cool, but I've been on 1, 2, 3 different occasions. I've been stuck at Intercontinental where someone's put that card into the payment things, and it's so heavy it goes in and it doesn't come back out. And then we're there waiting. It's it's midnight. I want to go home, and then we've got to wait 10 minutes for a technician to come and pry this person's metal card out of the machine.
In the parking thing.
Don't use the metal card.
I have the metal card
on the way out.
Use the metal card on anything that actually takes the card away.
That's the thing.
You.
Anything that the card goes in, and that's what I'm wondering. This thing has to have a little bit of circuitry, a little bit of electronics. I'm just wondering how many of these are going to jam up. Yeah, it's got the buttons on the front. It's not going to go into the kind of ATMs that take your card in and spit it back out. I bet that's not going to last long.
Well,
that could be
use it on those ATMs.
subtract the convenience.
So carry them all around and the swipe card.
And the swipe card. Carry your all cards plus the swipe card.
So, Jay, here's the thing. Chip and PIN is a brand name adopted by a UK banking institution. So I've heard a lot of I've heard PIN and chip over here. I wonder if that's like it's the same, but legally it's not because we're not paying royalties kind of thing. It might be a brand name, and that's why.
You would think the UK would have chosen
what I was doing.
Chip and PIN is Chip and PIN trademark.
Well, when I was researching my trip to Iceland, one of the things that came up a lot in the conversations was the fact that a lot of the gas stations in the remote areas are unmanned.
Mm-hmm.
And that if you want to get gas, you either have to have a prepaid gas card or a chip. And they always said Chip and PIN.
Chip and PIN over there.
That's where I learned the term from.
How do you say Chip and PIN in Icelandic?
Chip and PIN.
Fortunately, you don't have to know any Icelandic in Iceland if you don't want to.
The nice thing about technology is, like, pretty much wherever you go, it sounds like English because we invent a lot of the computer words, but with an accent.
Words. Yeah,
exactly. Except the one computer, you know, that's Russian.
But I did hear a great a slang term in Spain. Slang term for geeks was an alphabet.
That's called alphabet.
They call it geeks and alphabet because of all the acronyms.
All the acronyms?
Yeah.
Oh, cool.
It's the Spanish, and I don't know the Spanish word for alphabet, but it was the Spanish.
Alphabet.
So another try-by-or fry. Have you guys heard of Ray? The super remote. It looks like a phone. It looks like a smartphone, but it's actually a remote. It's an aluminum encased.
Everybody loves Ray.
An aluminum encased slab with a few physical buttons on the side for power, mute, and volume. Otherwise, everything happens on the touch screen where they want to get past the kind of buttons on your usual universal remote.
How does it compare to the Harmony One?
I don't know. I got a Harmony remote. Just
well, because
recently.
The Harmony One is the big, big square one that was all touch screen.
I had,
it was
so
like
$1,000
or something.
Yeah, I didn't have the Harmony One.
This is sized and works like a smartphone.
I don't
so
think
to use
this
it,
is going
to
do
through it.
I'm sorry, I don't think it's going to do well, but just it's got like three or four buttons on the side like a smartphone. And I know that, you know, when I reach for a remote, you know, for the most time, I want a remote that when I get it in my hand, I can tell which side's up, which side's down. I don't want to look at the remote. I don't want to have to hunt out buttons. I want it to fit in my hand. I want to be able to tell where the buttons are. And with this, because it's a smart screen, you give up that tactile feel, and I don't think it's going to be the same.
But that's what a lot of people said about the iPhone and tactile keyboards, too.
The haptic feedback is one thing, but being able to feel like the bumps and feel the buttons, that's, you know.
But does this do IR remote or does it only do TCP/IP remote?
I bet it's both.
It has IR Blaster, Wi-Fi, Bluetooth, and Zigbee built in.
Everything, except for buttons. Physical buttons.
Well, I got one of those Harmony remotes, one of the actual, you know, programmable remotes.
Yeah, I have one of those.
And you can plug it in through USB, and you can tell it what devices you have, and it pairs up with stuff real nice.
My experience with those is they're only marginally less terrible than regular universal remotes.
It did not really make it so much easier to use everything that I didn't just keep all the...
I like the micros. I like being able to program, like, say, hey, when I hit this button, turn this on, switch this, do the brightness here,
do all
that.
See, I've got that, which I like. The problem I have is that, you know, it's one set of buttons, and so, you know, I'll say I want to watch Blu-ray, and so now it's like, well, yeah, the volume works, and... fast forward and rewind and play and pause, all that works. Ooh, now I need to get into this section of the menu or whatever, and I don't know which button it is. Mm. You know, it's like it's mapped to one of these buttons, but I have no idea which one it is because it's randomly what it's going to do. You know,
you can
like,
go in and reprogram those, can't you?
But if the Ray looking at the Ray super remote that we're talking about. It does have that smartphone feel. It looks like you can dial in the apps for being able to do all your different things. So if they start letting people say, you know, like Xfinity has an app for their product, you know, their different apps for the different products, if they can be installed onto here and then you can create shortcuts, it might be.
Then why not just go back to your cell phone, though? Because I've got just as
IR?
As many cell phones. Yeah. Well, they used to.
Some
and, and it also wouldn't good do point the kind of multi-device type stuff well, that, where it's yeah controlling.
Well, they
also
but they XP do have the device, you know, for the home automation where it connects to your Wi-Fi network and it sends IR mm-hmm if needed. It has yep a little IR.
And we're getting into the realm of, you know, like Chromecast and things like that. I find myself, you know, watching more stuff via Chromecast on TV now than I do anything else, just because I've got this in my hand. I don't have to go find the remote. You
but
know,
is Chromecast that IR or is TCP?
Chromecast, it's Wi-Fi.
Okay, but like the Amazon Fire Stick is it TCP/IP? No, it's IR.
Is it?
I think no, hold IR on, the Fire Stick?
Yeah.
But I wouldn't think it would be IR.
I think it's
IR,
Wi-Fi.
Maybe. I wouldn't think it'd be
I'm
IR.
I'm guessing. It's still, I still think it's really cool to watch, and this is probably a generational thing, even when you don't have IR remote control, say like it's radio pure, where it doesn't matter which direction you point it, you could be outside the house. It's still cool to see people like point their phones or point the remote at the TV yeah and then hit the buttons. I think it's old habits.
I think
the Fire Stick uses Bluetooth.
I think the future probably is more towards this direction, but I have a feeling that what's going to dominate in the end will be something where your smartphone itself does it. You know, because the idea, you know, Barrett was talking about the buttons, you know, pushing the buttons to change the channels and that. The idea with the smartphone type one is that the directory is on the device. So you look at the device because you can scroll through the program listings a lot faster than you can on the TV. And then you click on the show that you want and you get the information and go. Because I will say I've been getting increasingly annoyed with the whole kind of stepping through and then you want more info on a program. It doesn't show enough in the little summary thing and you hit the info button and you have to wait and then it puts up a new screen and
the augmented
if you
screen
want to record
stuff
or that kind of stuff.
Yes, yeah, I think like, you know, if we look at like home packages, I think Plex gets it right. So if you know, if you have like, say like you install Plex on like, you know, your smart Samsung TV and Samsung now knows you're running Plex, you know, what your phone shows, you know, it gives like a little backdrop, it gives you some navigation, you can look at the synopsis and it's decoupled from what you're actually doing on the TV. So if you want to, you can go find out information about the show while it's actually playing.
Screen.
Yeah, it's neat. That would be a good use for this. But again, can we talk price points? Is it?
It's $200 price point.
Okay,
so it's $200. Yeah.
So it's like a cheap Android phone.
It's like a expensive universal remote.
Yeah.
Is what it is.
Okay.
There's two. I mean, so in my opinion, there's two aspects here. One is that remotes. I mean, this is an area that's rife for, I hate to use the tech term, but that's rife for disruption. Because I don't think you find anybody in the world who doesn't think that
So you're saying Nest is working on one.
Maybe. I don't think you'd be able to find anyone in the world who doesn't say that remote controls just suck. They just universally are terrible.
That's what universal remote control means. I finally get it.
Yeah, universally terrible. And the other side of it is that entertainment, you know, TV shows, movies, they're commoditized. You don't necessarily care what network shows whatever show. You want to watch your show. And so the idea of a remote where maybe you can pull it up, look at the screen, and click, I want to watch, you know, this show, Walking Dead, or whatever you're watching, Breaking Bad or Better Call Saul, you press the thing on the remote makes the TV play the thing, and then you've got your volume control.
Load Lee's stories.
Yeah, you know, whatever. That's... You know,
like an electronic TV guide.
You want a device that aggregates all the content, and you want all the content to be available on demand ahead of time.
And it shouldn't be so complicated that it looks like you need a remote for the remote because the remote's so complicated. And that's what a lot of these universal remotes are falling into this huge trap of.
Well, plus, one thing that nobody's done, which you'd think, again, it goes to your point about it being ripe for disruption, is, you know, why wouldn't your TV, you know, that it knows what channels you watch all the time, why wouldn't it have the option where it shows the channels in the order of how often you watch them? So that the first 10 channels are on the guide or whatever are the ones that you always go to.
There were some firmware sets that did that.
That sounds like something that an advertiser would want to monetize and that a TV station would want to pay in order to have a place on that list.
I can't remember if we talked about this or mentioned it last week, but the Samsung smart TVs, people have been sniffing those, and those are, I think right now it's just for advertising purposes and to see, you know, what people are watching, but they're reporting back quite a bit of information about you. So they're getting smarter by learning from you.
I don't want reporting on me, but I want to understand. You know, that could be local information that is useful to me, where it's keeping track that, hey, that it doesn't take much to keep track that, you know, I don't know, at my house that the cooking channel is on a lot, or DIY, and putting those up towards the top, and the channels that I rarely view
should
be way down at the
bottom.
That
information is much more useful to ComScore or Quantcast or DoubleClick or whoever. That's,
maybe AT&T's working on it.
I will say this about the, I have the Xfinity X1 platform, and what I like about that is that with the remote, I can start typing in the name of whatever it is that I want to watch. Mm-hmm. And it will, I can pull up a listing. Like if I'm interested in, you know, maybe Ghostbusters is on the schedule sometime coming up and I don't know when it is, I can type in Ghostbusters. It'll show me all the times it's available on free. It'll also show me if it's available for the pay-per-view. I can pull the show up and then I can bring up a menu that allows me to set all my recordings and stuff, so I can DVR it as I need to. That's a kind of a cool interface where I'm basically, you kind of have to know the content you want. And this, I mean, you can also search other ways and look at schedules and stuff, but I know that there are shows that, I'll see an advertisement for a program coming up, like, you know, next week is the world broadcast premiere of Better Call Saul. So I type in BETTER. There brings up the listing for that, and I can set my record option and off I go. That's a very nice feature to have. And I'd like to have all of my content available that way, just to be able to search for it. And I'd like to be able to have that happen where it would look at my Plex media server. It would look at Netflix. It would look at
your Amazon, see if you had anything on
where
Play.
Where is
yeah.
it, and how do I watch it? And then, okay, now I know where it is, and I push this button, and it starts, and the TV changes over to the right interface and allows me to see.
I think that's going
to
be the tallest order, is getting, you know, a device where Apple says, yeah, come on in, where Amazon says, yeah, come on in, and where Google Play says, yeah, come on in. Because
that's
so
what,
far, it's like you can choose two, but you can't get all three.
That's what Microsoft
device.
Has done.
Sort of,
right?
With Xbox, I guess?
Well, I'm actually just saying with their OS, because you know, they write this OS and it has to work with every possible piece of hardware that anybody wants to slap into it.
You've taken a jump to containerized virtualization. But it's a good jump.
So, and then the last on Try By Your Friday Night is more of a concept than a specific product, or it's a feature on a product. It sounds like Apple is looking at expanding Touch ID to other devices.
Like a car.
Current rumors, yeah.
Like a Knight Rider.
Current rumors have it that the forthcoming 12-inch MacBook Air could also sport a Touch ID sensor positioned above its trackpad, according to Taiwanese blog Apple Corner, which has cited supply chain sources. You know, they mentioned it for the iPad Air 2 and were correct.
I
so.
Think I had this on my ThinkPad in 1990.
So are they going to redesign the keyboard for all the nine-fingered IT security specialists?
But the thing about it is, it does seem, unlike other ones with the scanning the fingerprint, it seems to work. I mean, I'm among the group of people who on my phone it works, and I've enjoyed it.
Oh yeah, same. I use the heck out of it.
You know, because I love that you just kind of, you know, pop your thumb on that button and hold it for a second, and suddenly you're in the phone. And now apps are starting to. My bank now, their app uses the Touch ID to log in with.
I would be curious to see if they've gotten around like all the attacks, like where you can make a rubber cement fingerprint and you get the body, you know, temperature right, and you get it to where it's a little bit electrostatic and it goes. Have they? Because that's really tough. It's, you know, you've got that balance between, you know, I want it to unlock every time someone puts a thumb on there, but at the same time, I don't want, I shouldn't be able to go and lift Lee's thumbprint, while he's sleeping and do something else.
They key off several things. You can't just hack it with fingerprints. There's been at least one demonstration of a spoof attempt that works without any problems, but it's a complex spoof attempt. You can't just like dust for prints and like put your fingerprint on a piece of tape and do it. It does more than that. And I know with mine, when I first got it and I was fiddling with it, I was able to unlock the phone by, I could wrap, and I've got a video of this, wrap my thumb in a banana peel and put it on the sensor, and it still unlocks even though I have a banana. So it's not just the fingerprint. There's some kind of electromagnetic component to it that they're using, and I don't know what it is.
It reads your aura.
Reads my thoughts.
Mine goes pretty quick. Brain. I mean, I've been impressed with how fast I can put my thumb on there and have it unlocked.
Yeah,
you know?
It goes pretty quick.
There's a little pause in unlocking, and it makes you think you have to leave your thumb there longer or your finger there longer, but you don't actually have to.
Although one tip for people, if you get stopped by the police and you don't want them looking at your phone, turn your phone, your iPhone that's got the fingerprint recognition thing, you want to turn the phone off and then turn it back on.
Oh yeah, that was a dumb court ruling.
The ruling is that if all you have to do is put your fingerprint on it and to unlock it, then the police can ask for that without a warrant. But if it's got a PIN, then
they can't.
It's still can't. It looks like it's still
Which
just fingerprint technology, but they've gotten a lot better at the fingerprint technology, to where you can't just like go and casually lift a print and make that work. You actually would have to have a professional style of print. But like Pete said, you know, the police have that, and then they're in.
More reason to put a passcode on your phone.
Circling back to the beginning of the show. On a laptop, it seems like, you know, we were talking about, you know, making it easier for people to, you know, secure their devices without having, you know, to try and get around the inconvenience of remembering passwords and that. Obviously, you have the fallback of the password, but if the print was your way to launch your laptop, that would not be a bad, I don't think that would be a bad thing, assuming they, you know, that they make sure it's really secure.
Yeah.
That you can't just Xerox a random thumbprint and stick it on there and have it work.
Well, HP did that thing. I don't know if they're still doing it or not, but they had that thing where the camera would recognize your face and it would log you in.
Didn't like Samsung do that on one of their phones or something?
I know there was some eye tracking software.
Yeah, there's even, I want to say, yeah, Android had a plugin for that for a while too. It just, you know, and I know that the face tracking technology, like a week or so, there were a lot of breakthroughs because traditionally, for face tracking technology,
well,
the main thing is it had to be from the front. So facial recognition mainly from the front. But they've got, I think it was MIT, and Pete, you may have seen this somewhere, MIT with a couple of other researchers, they came out to where the new algorithm can hit profiles from both sides. It can do quite a bit. So instead of, you know, like getting like 80% of the people walking straight through, it can identify most people just by, you know, a half profile or a slightly obscured face, or, you know, like 50% of a face, which is kind of scary.
That's cool.
Yeah, cool/scary.
Well, you know, you think about it from a security standpoint. I mean, you know, imagine when your two-factor authentication is thumbprint or, you know, finger, because I mean, you can choose whichever finger you want for your phone, that Touch ID. And then also, I mean, if you take your phone out and you're holding it out anyway to put your thumb on it, if it's using the camera to check that you are you, that's not too bad.
Yes.
Stanford University.
The day could come, and
Yahoo Labs,
come where that would work.
Yeah, they're calling it Deep Dense is the software package, and it was jointly developed by Stanford University and Yahoo Labs. So it looks like it's going to be out there in the wild pretty soon.
Good. No more fooling those facial recognition scanners.
Yeah, if nothing else, it'll up the Facebook.
Well, I think in Japan they had like vending machines that were putting out things that were only for adults, and so they used a facial recognition to see that you looked old enough, and the kids quickly found out that like a magazine cover that had a celebrity's face large enough would fool the age tracking facial recognition software, and they could buy their beer or whatever it was.
They were doing some cool stuff like that too. I know they were doing facial recognition, and they would actually remember your beverage purchase history and make recommendations based on, you know, time of year, based on what other people were drinking, based on a whole lot of different factors, which is kind of cool. It's a little invasive, but actually that machine got really popular.
This is why I carry a photograph of Jay Lee in my pants all the time. All day, every day.
Let me out.
You know, I can get you a 3D model of him.
Oh, yes! With a smooth head.
Well, on the another facial recognition, it's more of a science thing, but apparently using some facial recognition technology, they found, you know,
faces?
They found a painting of Anne Boleyn that they had thought was maybe one of Henry VIII's other wives. And by using this facial recognition software, they determined that it actually was a picture of her. Because after she was executed, they went through and like destroyed all the images of her for whatever reason. I mean, it's like he didn't do that about the rest of his wives, but hers, they got rid of the images. And so there's very few paintings around. And then, of course, that means there's not paintings to compare to figure out if two paintings are both of the same person. And they using this facial recognition technology, they determined from one of the ones that they do know for sure was her that this other painting, who they thought was one of his other wives, was actually a painting of her.
One of the other wives might be in the house behind you. We heard squeaks. So that's really cool. So they thought the portrait before, the one that they now think rather is Anne Boleyn. They thought it was Jane Seymour. And I'm looking at the picture, and that doesn't look like Dr. Quinn at all.
Yeah, I was going to say, isn't Jane Seymour an actress?
Yeah. History joke.
But the fascinating part is that the facial recognition software apparently was better able to determine that than people looking at it. I mean, normally you would think that the software would be weaker at that a person could look at it and go, oh no, these are two paintings of the same person, but the facial recognition software did a better job than the experts.
So this could be interesting. So I guess throughout the ages, and I dated a girl in college. It was an art history major, so I took way too much art history just to be around, you know, and get in there. So anyway, this is cool. So there have always been like a lot of people in the backgrounds, and you know, a lot of painters, you know, would paint in the mistresses, or you know, the people that, you know, commissioned, the patrons would say like, hey, paint in the mistress, and a lot of them were unknown. I think they were known to some court insiders and stuff like that. But with this technology, I wonder if, you know, we're not going to unravel some dirty secrets back from, you know, I guess all the way from the Renaissance all the way up. Because there's some cool stuff. It's like there are seven legendary mistresses in art history. There, you know, like, and there are more than that. But, you know, there are known women that everyone's kind of curious about who they are and how they fit into things. And everyone knows that they're somehow important, but no one can connect the dots. So this could be kind of cool, you know, applying new technology to old problems.
Fascinating.
Talk about the Da Vinci Code.
That movie was real?
literal Da Vinci Code. Mona Lisa.
That was real, but Tom Hanks is fictional.
But
there's going to be some of these guys are going to get in trouble. If you Google seven legendary mistresses in art history, some of these guys, if they're found out, I'm sure they're no longer alive. But yeah, there's going to be some rows and some families. Whoa, some of these are racy. Yeah, be careful.
Is this not safe for work? Safe for work.
The Japanese stuff is very Japanese. No tentacles, though.
All right, well, I think we're getting close to where we wind down, but a couple, since weird science is still out there.
All right, go for it.
I have a few, but there's only a couple that are really worth it. An interesting one, you know, usually you hear there's the news stories where they do something and they kind of, the press overhypes it. This one I haven't really seen covered, and it's more interesting in a geeky way. Talking about HIV, you know, the researchers have been trying to figure out ways to get around, you know, to foil HIV. And now a research team has shown that a lab-made molecule that mimics an antibody from our immune system may have more protective power than anything the body produces. Basically, they looked at the AIDS virus, you know, they deconstructed it genetically, and they made this molecule, this protein, to connect up very specifically to the AIDS virus.
Wait a minute, Peter. Isn't this how zombie movies start?
It's only a problem to the AIDS virus. The protein. Let's see.
The cure for cancer is what started out legend. I think.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, this one though, the deal is, it's like this particular protein is just sort of perfect for clogging up the HIV virus, and they've given it to monkeys. Now they haven't tested it on humans yet, but they gave it to monkeys and then gave them massive AIDS virus doses, you know, like injecting live virus right into them for up to 34 weeks. You know, they kept going higher up, you know, they kept putting more and more virus, and none of those animals got HIV, where all of the untreated ones did.
But now they talk.
Planet of the Apes. And those scientists are going to be the first ones against the wall.
As long as Marky Mark doesn't show up, I'm fine.
So it's a new, new approach. It's basically gene therapy, and that actually seems to work. And so they're going to be trying some more stuff, and you know, so I thought that one was interesting. If you read up on it, there's a lot more kind of deep and geeky detail that we don't have time to go into on it, but it was pretty cool. I mean, it's more of an sort of an engineering approach in a sense to it. And a couple quick hits, the dwarf planet that we had the GIF about last week.
Yeah.
Apparently, as they get these higher images, there's some real mysteries. They don't know, if you look at it, it's got craters and bright spots on it. So there's like shiny spots on this dwarf planet, and they really don't know what they are. They don't know why it's reflecting so much light. So there's a mystery that hopefully as the spacecraft gets closer, we'll be able to figure out what the heck is going on.
Are they communicating with Mars? I'm assuming the two plumes on Mars were related somehow. Have you guys seen this?
No.
Like, so astronomers, I guess this was a week ago. There's two, and they're not exactly sure that we don't really have an explanation for it yet, but two large plumes are coming up from the Martian surface. We don't know if it's like a gas ejection. And again, I read this 5 days ago, so they may know by now, but it looked kind of interesting.
The plumes, they're the launches of some cylinders that have landed near New Jersey.
Careful, you'll be creating a panic. I'm pretty sure that pretending that you're doing a War of the Worlds newscast is against FCC violent regulations.
Hey, it's going to be pretty good that now. People can actually tell that I was doing that.
They appear to be moving in a triangular formation toward the edge of the farm.
Oh, humanity!
Oh my gosh, they still can't kill Tom Cruise.
Why don't we do an entire show talking in... Turning in old newscaster voices.
Catherine Hepburn.
FCC says no.
Now you're on the trolley. Now you're on the trolley.
You old coot.
Remember that episode of Archer when he got captured by the guy on the old-timey plane?
Yes.
Is this a ruse?
Talks that way.
Oh, and finally, the other one that's been all over the news, but it's worth mentioning, is the Mars One Foundation. I'm assuming none of the participants in the show have tried to sign up, and they certainly didn't make the Mars 100.
I didn't.
This is the private nonprofit that
those Johnnies
that are sending people on
a
one-way trip to Mars. Hmm?
I tell you, they're not going to make it.
Hey, now, let's find a lot of wood. They're certainly not going to make it back.
It's a one-way trip.
We can joke about that.
They know they're not going to come back, but the real question, yeah, is how long do they figure they'll be there? Because I think that's what MIT thought, that they assessed the life expectancy of the first death would happen within the first 64 days they were there.
Well, one of the, I want to say, I don't know if it's a UK young lady or an Aussie. I think she's Australian. But she actually wants to go and be the first woman to give birth on Mars. So
lovely.
We'll see how that works out.
Yeah.
My desire as a young person was to be the first human to die naturally of old age in space.
The timing would be, or you could just go somewhere really far
but basically it would mean that we had made it into space and were going somewhere and had colonized enough that somebody who's old would have been able to live in space
would
to be able
terrified
to,
in a state
to be able
of
to die, you know.
Just to go with me, because we'd be lost.
Is being terrified while suffering from dementia while being blasted
in space.
Into space on a rocket qualify as a natural death?
That's kind of like the latch ditch, just like, you know, I'm going to get what I wanted as a child version.
Let's load him up in that cargo rocket. He's fine. Don't even worry about
Lou
it.
Lou flicked his wheelchair to the launch pad.
Is this enough room and candles? I don't know.
Give him a Reader's Digest and he'll be fine.
All right.
No,
Grandpa.
Yes, so Mars 1,
so,
yeah.
So the last,
go forward,
so the last
go
words flicked forward. Would hear would be, clean up on the shuffleboard deck.
So 50
deck.
Men, 50 women, and they're going to pare it down to what's 24. The final number?
20. I think the final number is 24.
And
four,
I think you
four
can go
teams
out,
of yeah. six or something.
Yeah, you can go out and you can actually see all the videos of everyone that applied. So I thought it was going to be, you know, like typical NASA kind of people, but it's not.
No.
It's everyone from, you know, like very old, but I would consider very old teenagers. So I think there's some 50.
Well, keep year in mind the, one of the primary ways that Mars One, the project, plans to raise funding is to film this debacle and sell the
it's
TV
like reality,
rights
reality
and run
TV.
It as a reality TV series.
Like Big Brother.
So yes. This could bring MTV back.
So
the real off-world.
I did a pretty big takedown of them a couple of months ago, back when they were originally doing stuff. One of their big problems is that their Mars transfer vehicle right now is a big fat TBD in their technical documentation. They're going to attempt to rely a lot on commercial space. They plan on buying capacity from. They plan on using Falcon rockets, Falcon 9 heavies. Once those fly, they've got like a big set of like loose plans, but they don't have a lot of, and they want to do the entire thing for $6 billion. And think about that for a second.
That's how much it costs to produce like gravity.
Yeah, that's a little less than that.
So for the cost of a really bad movie, you too.
They want to do
million
it,
or billion?
Billion.
So they're a little phasey.
$6 billion.
They're a little phasey on. That's not the right word.
Fuzzy?
Fuzzy and hazy.
Fuzzy.
On step two, right?
Right, right. Question mark.
But step three is profit.
No, actually, step three is everyone dies on Mars. The idea is to be like sort of the foothold for permanent human settlement.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, when you look at what their plan is, it's like we're going to get... I think the initial one is we want to get like four people, or it's either four or six people.
24 strangers and putting them all in one capsule and see what unfolds.
They're not going to do that many. They're many to start with. It's either going to be four people or six people, but they want to have an initial landing of like either four. I think it's four.
Are they teaming up with the producers of Survivor for this?
I think this is going to be cool. You're voted out of the capsule.
So this is
the airlock.
This is sort of like the CEO of this company or organization. LARPing Oregon Trail.
Kind of.
Yeah.
Except
kind
of
cool.
in a going to Mars
people,
setting.
Send them to Mars, and then the idea is after you've got your four people there first, and the whole time they're there, you're filming them, and there's like, you know, Big Brother on Mars, except you can't go outside.
You're screening for dysentery the entire time, I'm assuming.
Like, you'll blow up like Total Recall.
This is a one-way trip,
and,
right?
And the, yes. So then, like, the second shipment of four people is going to come, and they're going to bring, like, a bigger habitat and more supplies.
And a hot tub.
And a hot tub. And then and extra bathing suits and you know, whatever.
What kind of suits?
Extra bathing suits for the hot tub.
And food.
And
it's Mars. Nobody's watching. Oh, wait a minute. All the cameras. Never mind.
And then they're going to send after that another four people. And, you know, each mission is going to build and resupply and make it
so
bigger.
So does the earlier habitat become like a repository for the people who die there?
Becomes Mars Classic.
It becomes a little mini graveyard. It's going to be, yeah.
They're not even...
All the
that's
new
where they
arrivals
make the...
are hipsters. They want to go retro. They're going to go to the first
That's
pods.
Where they make the Mars prison wine.
At best. At best. I got to agree with what MIT
Donner
says.
Party of four.
The best, like the most advanced these people are going to get, the furthest along this project is going to get is it's going to either blow people up on the launch pad or it's going to, these people are going to strangle to death or die from radiation poisoning during their 6-month transit to Mars. And I think personally the odds of them even approaching anything that looks remotely like a launch with actual hardware is got to be 1,000 to 1. This is going to collapse in lawsuits, tears, and retribution way before any actual hardware gets lifted.
Right,
that's the main reason we've got Leon on the show is because of his rosy optimism.
That's really what he brings.
Right, Kickstarter. I would think that people would try to shut this down or the, you know, they say,
No. This is it's not an American project either. It's like Swedish or something. Peter, if you've got
assisted suicide's legal there, so this is totally kosher.
is what's the country that Mars won? It's not the U.S.
If you want to read about this project, there it's mars-1.com.
Maybe it's that
that
World War II platform that's off the coast of England.
Oh, Sealand.
Yeah, this is sponsored by Sealand.
I mean, before we do anything, we need to go to the dark side of the moon and see what that whole German thing is about.
Yeah,
that's you know, I saw that for the first time. That's a really
it was not as good a movie as I thought.
No, the preview is really, really good. The preview is good.
The second one
looks really good.
That's not a computer. This is a computer.
Space Station 76 is what I want to see.
Space Station 76.
Is that like a, is that a club in
it's
San Francisco?
Like, it's a club in space. Space Station movie based on 70s humor and stuff.
Oh, it's a 2014 release. Yeah. It's fairly recent.
I hear music.
Yeah, the next Iron Sky is not till 2016, right?
You can always watch Dead Snow.
Oh, there's a Dead Snow 2 now.
There you go.
All right. Well, that was ridiculous.
Yes. Thanks, Peter.
Bye, Pete.
All right. Well, you have been listening to Technology Bites. We had a nice romp through conversation here tonight. We hope you enjoyed it. Hope that'll inspire you to tune in again next week for more Technology Bites. In the meantime, we're out of here. I'm Jay Lee.
I'm Peter Hughes.
I'm Flicted.
I'm Barrett.
I'm Lee.
And he's
Roofhouse.
Roofhouse.
For the month of February, 90.1 KPFT has been selected as one of the local nonprofits competing for your vote at Okra Charity Saloon in downtown Houston. The concept is simple. For each drink purchased, guests receive one vote that they may cast that night for their favorite organization. The charity with the most votes at the end of the month receives the next month's proceeds. Okra is located at 924 Congress, near the corner of Main Street and Congress. Again, throughout the month of February, KPFT is one of the candidates for support. You can chip in to vote with the purchase when you patronize Okra. You can visit Okra on Congress anytime in February to cast a vote for KPFT. This is 90.1 KPFT Houston, kpft.org worldwide.
You listen to KPFT, you enjoy some of our fine programming, and you have done your part to keep us commercial-free by calling in a pledge of support. Hats off to you for taking that first step. But before you settle into that fantastic feeling, don't forget, you still need to send in that pledge of support to finalize your promise to KPFT. But be warned, that fantastic feeling will soon follow. Thanks for supporting KPFT Houston. You listen to KPFT, you enjoy some of our fine programming, and you have done your part to keep us commercial-free by calling in a pledge of support. Hats off to you for taking that first step. But before you settle into that fantastic feeling,